Says they were scourged by the Pharisee. They cursed the name of God who had the power of these plagues. That's not it. 16:19 says the great city, of course, that's Babylon, was split into three parts. So even before these three chapters, we've seen that Babylon is going to fall, but it's going to reach its climax in both chapters 18 and 19, and again, it gives us a more detailed account of the destruction of Babylon, or we might say Rome, but it's the collapse of the anti-Christian world order that we see here. In fact, it is so certain of this collapse that it speaks of it in past tense, as if it's already happened. So what can we say about Babylon itself? Because we use that term in Revelation quite often. Well, its goal was to turn people away from God, and its influence was worldwide, or it was cosmic. And she rules over the kings of the earth, Scripture tells us. And it's the center of seduction and of any age that we see like that, and we see it throughout all of history. And she's symbolic, one author said, of the pleasure-mad, arrogant world and the anti-Christian philosophy, which I think we see all around us today as they did then. Can you think of any examples of anti-Christian philosophy, or as you look around, you read things, as you listen to things? Do you think we're in the majority and everybody loves us?
Did you sit here?
Did you say marriage?
You say what?
Marriage.
In what way?
A man and a woman.
Okay.
Or as the world defines it.
Mm-hmm.
Just whoever you so choose. Yeah. Gender. You know, the role of male and female. Man and woman. And the list goes on. You can take anything from Scripture. What is Alan described as a prescriptive will. And, the world defines it completely opposite.
Mm-hmm.
It's against Christ and against God and his law.
Yeah.
You take the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not lie. The general theme out there is that everyone lies. Everyone lies to each other. And the media, you know, presents itself as a lying theme on TV, on national TV. You have world leaders who lie to their people. Mm-hmm. So you can see the anxiety.
Where are some of the pockets that we see it maybe at its worst? Well, okay, that's not what I was thinking, but you're right. That's one. You know, the left post were part of it.
Yeah. I would say our justice system and our courts. What is evil and evil is good. I see it.
Do you vow shall not commit adultery?
That's right.
If you do, you might get in big trouble.
That's right. More levels in one. I was thinking about.
I mean, and you see on television, but you don't see it in real life.
Right.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking of. Jerry mentioned the media. There's a book I read years ago. It's called, I can't remember the author's name, but I recommend it to you. It's called Hard America, Soft America. Anybody read that? He was talking about the certain areas of business, of military, of education, and of government, you know, and those places that remain predominantly what's called hard, pulling the line, have been more successful. The military is one of those, business is one, but education has gone totally soft. And especially, I think, in the universities. But it doesn't stop there. It's trickled down into the public schools, because that's where all the teachers are trained at the university level. And I think there's a great anti-God, anti-Christian philosophy that's prevalent in all levels of education now. And not that there's not good pockets of good schools, but anything else? Any other examples? Free governments, I think, and all the tentacles of governments, whether it be the court system or what have you.
And all the bias and anarchy that prevails in the kingdom of Rome is 14, and what our responsibility is to government and to those in authority over us. And anyone is shut any authority whatsoever. If you can't restrain me, I can do whatever is right in my own eyes.
Yep.
The days of Solomon. So, the people in general, in men's hearts, wicked and deceitful.
I know it's been bad at times, but I haven't seen it as bad as it seems to be now, especially with the transfer of power in this last election that we've seen here. Let's read the first, let's go through the first three verses of chapter 18 of Revelation. Would somebody want to read the first three verses?
After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory. And he called out with a mighty voice, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for demons, a haunt for every unclean spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable beast. For all the nations have drunk the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have grown rich in the power of her luxurious living."
Okay. Question. First two words of chapter 18, verse 1. After this. My question is, after what? What just preceded this?
After the Babylon.
No. What just preceded this? What did John see in his vision that he was granted in chapter 5? Well, 16 precedes this, or 17. Look at 17:1. That'll help us. Says, "After this, come and I'll show you what? The judgment of the great prostitute." Who was the great prostitute that we studied last week? Who is that symbolic of?
False religion.
And I like what I was reading a commentary or a portion of what Dr. John MacArthur said. He said there's two aspects of this. We see it in the beast of the sea and the beast of the earth. There's a commercial Babylon and there's a religious Babylon. And neither one is good. So he says, "After this, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was made bright with his glory." That's kind of a reflected glory. It's the same thing we saw Moses when he came down from Mount Sinai. He had a reflected glory there. And we see it also described when we talk about God himself in Revelation 1:6. And in Revelation 5:12, it speaks of Christ having that same glory. Turn over to Ezekiel chapter 43. We'll see it very similar to what we're reading here in 18:1, that this angel was made bright with his glory. Ezekiel 43, let's go to 1 through 5. "Then he led me to the great gate, the gate facing east, and behold, the glory of God of Israel was coming from the east, and the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory." Again, a reflected glory. "And the vision that I saw was just like the vision I had seen when he came to destroy the city, just like the vision that I had seen by Chebar Canal, and I fell on my face as the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east, and the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple." So this glory, this weightiness is always associated with the presence of either God the Father or even Christ, or sometimes his emissaries, his angels. We see this, and even we saw it in Moses. So we see it quite often. And look at verse 2, talking about Babylon herself has become a great dwelling place for demons, for unclean spirits, unclean bird, unclean and detestable beast. That's the description given to Babylon. And we see that also in Isaiah 13. Go to Isaiah 13. And look at verses 21 and 22. And not ironically, but look at that. This is chapter 13. It's talking about the judgment of Babylon. So look at 20 and 21. This is the actual old Babylon. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherd will make their flocks lie down there. But wild animals will lie down there. And their houses will be full of howling creatures. Their ostriches will dwell, and there will be wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers, and the jackals in the pleasant palaces. Very similar description to what we see here in Revelation chapter 3. We see something today, Chernobyl. You ever thought about it? Very similar to Chernobyl. You know what's at Chernobyl now within about a 50-mile radius? Wild animals. In fact, the scientists are going in studying those animals, the wolves and all the other animals in the food chain, to see how the radiation's affected them. So it seems very similar to what we see in Chernobyl today. But that's going to be the fate of Babylon. And if you look, John is, and we are seeing almost a 180-degree vision. They're looking back and they're calling, for the first century Christians, a code word, Rome, Babylon. And they can look at the example of what happened to Babylon and how it fell, and how it fell quickly. And then for the first century Christians, they see that this is going to happen to Rome herself, the Roman Empire. Rome lasted for almost 1,000 years and never rose again in that same form. And then we look forward to the future, to this anti-God world that we see right now, and it's going to be a total defeat of that. And it's going to be swift, and it's going to be sure. In verse 3, tells us a reason for the fall of Babylon. Look at verse 3. Why? Why is Babylon falling? For all the nations have drunk the wine of her passion, of her sexual immorality. And what is that a code word for, the sexual immorality? Spiritual idolatry. Going away from God. So verse 3 tells us one of the reasons. Now look at verse 4. Then I heard another voice from heaven saying, listen to what it says, come out of her, my people, lest you take part in her sins, lest you share in her plagues. For her sins are heaped high as heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back as she herself has paid back others, and repay her double for her deeds. Mix a double portion for her in the cup she mixed. As she glorified herself and lived in luxury, so give her a like measure of torment and mourning. Since in her heart she says, I sit as a queen, I am no widow. In mourning I shall never see. For this reason her plagues will come in a single day, death and mourning and famine, and she will be burned up with fire. For the Almighty is Lord God who has judged her. Very, very sobering words that we have there. And you notice he starts out here and the angel says, come out of her, my people. Have we heard that before in Scripture? Did the people of God ever been called to come out before? Now, go to Isaiah. Let's look at a couple passages. Isaiah 48, very similar language. Isaiah 48:20, some people read that.
Go forth from Babylon, flee from the Chaldeans, inquire with the sound of joyful shouting, proclaim this, send it out at the end of the earth. Say, the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob.
Okay, and so again, go out from Babylon and flee. How about Jeremiah 51? Go to Jeremiah 51. Let's go to the right a little bit. And verse 45. And talking about Babylon as far as context. So somebody read 45.
Go out of the midst of her, my people. Let everyone save his life from the fierce anger of the Lord.
Okay, because what? The judgment is going to fall upon Babylon. You know, and that's a warning. One of the authors said the church is in the world, but the world must never be in the church. Examples of the world being in the church. As you look around today, and when we talk about the church, the professing Christian church, what are examples of the world being in the church?
Style of worship that's in some churches.
The teaching of philosophy and self-help and all the psychology of the world instead of teaching
Bible. Yeah. I was at a funeral for one of my cousins not long ago in a church here in Minville. Jesus was not there.
Yeah.
His name was never mentioned in prayer or anything else.
And at all times at a funeral, you would think.
Yeah.
Oftentimes now you hear nothing but anecdotal stories. What is it? Was it Spurgeon that he had a sign behind his pulpit that said, what is it? They came to see Jesus. You know, and he made sure he always preached Jesus. And so we get all sorts of things. But that health, wealth, and prosperity, where it is so man-centered that we are here to be healthy, and we're here to be prosperous financially, and it just doesn't ring true, and that has entered the church. Other examples?
I think what Jeremy said is a good example, because the church is made it okay to be married and be whatever.
Yeah, very specific. There's a lot of denominations, not just individual churches within denominations, but the denomination leadership has now accepted homosexual marriage, I think, of the Episcopal Church. I think of some, the United Methodist Church, and I'm sure there are others. Ironically, if there's any good news, within the Episcopal community, which is part of a broader Anglican community, and of course the Anglican Church, in my opinion, in Europe, especially in England, is totally bankrupt, but there are very conservative pockets of the Anglican Church in Africa that reject what the leadership in England and of course the Episcopal Church is doing here, and they would actually like to separate from them. So there's still pockets, even within those denominations that we so easily point to, that still are giving up a valiant fight for what is right and for what is good. I was listening last night, I was channel surfing, and I would channel surf TBN. I confess, I do it all the time. I don't stay on it long because my stomach can't take it. But Billy Graham was on, one of the old Billy Graham crusades was on, and I like what he said. That whether it be a church, whether it be us as individuals, we are the church as individuals. He said, how many of us camp outside of Sodom? You know what he means by that? Can you guess what he means by that? How many of us camp outside like Lot, outside of Sodom? We know better. We kind of cozy up to certain things. Maybe not doctrinal things. Maybe they are doctrinal things. But a worldly lifestyle, you know, and we kind of like those certain sinful pleasures and things like that. But how many of us camp outside of Sodom and get a little too close for our own good and for our own benefit? What about Demas? Do you remember Demas? One of the great biblical characters?
Yeah.
Do you? Well, turn over to remind you, turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 4. And verse 10. I hope. In Demas, a little background. Anybody give us a background about poor old Demas there? Demas professed to be a Christian. Kind of even liked to hang out with the Christians, you know. And look what it says here, verse 9 and 10. Of course, Paul is writing to Timothy a very poignant letter. It's one of my favorites. But he says, talking to Timothy, do your best to come to me soon. Remember, what's Paul's predicament here? He's in prison. And this is probably his last time on earth. He says, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. He's deserted me. Why? His love of this present world. He camped a little too close to Sodom. And we, whether it be church denominations or we as individuals in the church, must examine our lives and must be careful to make sure that we're not a Demas. It was so easy to go to that. Reminder in Leviticus, it says to be holy is what? It's I am holy. Turn over also to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. If somebody reads 6:14.
Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership has righteousness with lawlessness? Or what fellowship has light with darkness?
Yeah. And again, it reminds us what it said in Revelation, to come out of Babylon. And it's a call to all of us. Pick your friends wisely. You know, bad company corrupts good morals. We should be even watching who we associate with. We see an example of that. The church, the elect, has always been called to be called out and to be different, to be separate from the end of that. And the persecuted church has always faced the temptation to compromise. Because there's a certain tension that's there constantly on the church. Oh, come on, just be like the rest of us. Oh, come on, accept transgender, accept homosexual marriage, accept this, accept that. And many churches crumble because of the sheer weight of the tension that's brought to bear upon them, either through their people within the congregation or through the media, through the press, through whatever. And the church has always been called to compromise. And it's hard to stand against that tide. Any other comments on that before we move on to the next verse?
Yeah. A biblical example that right here in Acts, and we'll get there next week, is Paul's there in Ephesus, and Demetrius brings the silversmiths together and says, this guy's ruining our business. He's ruining the economy. People aren't buying our products anymore. So there's the world going to persecute a Christian because of that. And I think pro-life movement is hurting the abortion doctors, you know. And so the church does get attacked for the fact that... So as it's, the church should impact, and we'll see this in Ephesus, the church actually impacted Ephesus. Mm-hmm. Not everybody became a Christian, but people were moved toward a more godly way.
Yeah. It attacked what we call, MacArthur says, the commercial Babylon. And in verse 6, it's talking about back in Revelation. Pay her back. If she herself has paid back others and paid her double for her deeds, she's going to get what's coming to her, a full requital for that. But notice how quick this destruction, this fall, is going to come in verse 8. For this reason, her plagues will come in a single day. It's going to come swiftly and it's going to come suddenly. You blink and you've missed it. And then we start in chapter or verse 9 and verse 220. And this is three dirges or three laments here of three different categories of peoples. And it's the kings of the earth, the merchants and the seafarers. This is the commercial Babylon that we're talking about. And when this fall of Babylon happens, it's going to be economic chaos. Very similar to what Alan was just talking about. And it's going to be a suddenness in verse 10. Look at verse 10. We don't need to read it. Verse 10, toward the end of verse 10, for a single hour your judgment has come. Skip over to verse 17, for a single hour all this wealth has been laid to waste. Look at verse 19. Flip the page if you need to. Last part of verse 19, for a single hour she has been laid waste. So it's going to be sudden. It's going to be in a single day. And think of old Babylon. Go back to the Old Testament. Think of how quickly old Babylon fell. Who was the king? And what did he see on the wall? Belshazzar. Remember Belshazzar?
Yeah.
He's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. This great, great Neo-Babylonian Empire, just because there was an older Babylonian Empire. Okay, this great Babylonian Empire that would rule, and it falls in a single night. And who fells them? Well, the Persians under Cyrus and his nephew Darius of the Medes. And so it goes quickly. So the people who are reading this, these first century believers as well as us, see this and they can think back to Daniel chapter 5 and say, Babylon fell quickly. And this Babylon will also fall that we see here. So we see all these laments. In each group, whether it be the kings of the earth, whether it be the merchants, or whether it be the seafarers, see this collapse from their own perspective, from their own viewpoint. You know, so we see these three dirges, these three laments here. And look at verse, let's somebody read, let's break it up. Let's go to the, somebody read verse, just verse 9. These are the kings of the earth.
And the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her when they see the smoke of her burning.
Oh, I'm sorry, do verse 10 too, my fault.
They will stand far off in fear of her torment and say, alas, alas, your great city, you mighty city, Babylon, for in a single hour your judgment has come.
Okay, the leaders of the nations of the earth are going to be perplexed, to say the least. Now look at verse 11. And let's read 11 through, let's stop, 11 through 16, if somebody would read that. Now we go to the merchants.
When the ark was finished, he who prayed the Lord.
Okay, somebody complete that.
And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen. And purple and silk and scarlet, and every kind of citron wood, and every article of ivory, and every article made from very costly wood, and bronze, and iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and spice, and incense, and perfume, and frankincense, and wine, and olive oil, and fine flour, and wheat, and cattle, and sheep, and cargoes of horses, and chariots, and slaves, and human lives. The fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you. And men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things, who became rich from her will, her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city, she who was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls.
Okay. So this is from the perspective of merchants. There's going to be economic chaos. All that seems so insurmountable is now going to collapse. To give you an idea, the first century Christian, when they were reading this, they understood this. I was reading some articles on this. Nero himself held a party, and he brought in Egyptian roses. Sounds reasonable, Egyptian roses. In today's cost, $100,000 worth of roses. That's a nice party to be to. Hopefully it lasted more than one day. Vitellius, another emperor, he would serve peacock brains and nightingale tongues. Now, being an animal lover, I'm offended already. But can you imagine how small a nightingale tongue was? Now, many of that had to do excessive Money's not evil, it's the love of money. Same thing for this. They estimated that Vitellius also spent on today's money $20 million in food in a single year. And that's pretty high living. That's pretty high living. The nobility in Rome ate from ivory plates. And also it talks about here, it talks about the slaves. In Rome at this time, in Rome at their peak, two out of every three citizens, or two out of every three people in Rome were slaves. 60 million slaves, they estimate. I was searching the internet last night, and it's amazing how you find things that relate to this. In Disneyland, which is in Anaheim, and don't get me wrong, I like Disneyland. I've been there 59 and 94, and that's two times I've been there. And I recommend it. It's great. But they now have a dinner. Have you read this? Anybody read this about this? They now have a dinner where you get your own personal chef. There'll be themes, a seven-course dinner for a mere $15,000. Excessive. I thought the tickets were bad. I can't imagine that $15,000 dinner. And it went into great detail on what you get for this. But we're there. You know, we're there, I think.
That's the highest price ticket sold so far for the Super Bowl this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, $15,000.
We're there. I thought the Super Bowl was this weekend, show you how much I was paying attention. I'm looking over the channel and I can't find it.
It's not really worth it.
Let's go on. If somebody would read, let's go to 17 through 20. If somebody read 17 through 20 now.
For a single hour, all the storm has been laid waste. And all shipmasters and seafaring men, sailors, and all those of trade on the seas stood far off and cried out as they saw the smoke of a burning. What city was like the great city? And they threw dust on their heads as they wept and mourned, crying out, "Alas, alas, for the great city, where all who had ships at sea grew rich by her wealth, for in a single hour she has been laid waste. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her."
Okay, here's the dirge, here's the lament. When the seafarer, those who brought all those cargo to them, it even affects them. In verse 20, though, look at the response of the saints, the response of those who have put up against all this persecution. It said, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets." There's some would speculate the fact that these are probably those that have died martyrs' deaths and have borne this persecution that we saw either under Nero or Domitian. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and prophets and saints and apostles and prophets, for God has given judgment for you against her." There's another reason for her fall, for the blood of the martyrs that we see here. Now in verse 21, "Then a mighty angel," this apparently is a different angel, this seems like, "a mighty angel took up a great stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, 'So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and be found no more.'" These are massive, massive stones that are being thrown into the sea. The imagery we see here is the fact it's never going to be recovered. It's bad enough if you lose your cell phone in the lake, you'll never find it. But if you throw a millstone in the sea, you're not going to recover it. And that is the point of this. And it says, "So Babylon the Great will be thrown down with violence, will be found no more. It is final." This final judgment that is coming upon the anti-world, anti-Christian order is going to be swift and it's going to be final. And this goes along with the theme of the book of Revelation. The theme of the book of Revelation is that Christ is victor. And that is meant to be a comfort to those who are suffering under persecution, even those who have already been martyred. And so it says, "So Babylon the Great will be thrown down with violence, will be found no more." Verse 22, "And the sound of the harpist and the musician, of flute players and trumpeters will be heard no more." Well, these particular instruments, the harps and the flutes, are associated with partying and carousing. The trumpets associated for games in the theater. If you ever saw Ben-Hur in the chariot races, you know all the trumpets and that great scene that they show there. It's all going to be totally silent. So the rejoicing and harlotry is going to hear no more. In verse 23, let's see, that's not... And the light of a lamp will shine in you no more, and the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will be heard in you no more. Total collapse. For your merchants were the great ones of the earth, and all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints, and of all who have been slain on earth. Another reason for her fall, for how she has treated the saints and through the murder. And of course, this would ring true to those first century Christians. Again, part of it depends on when was this written. Either way, it affects these first century Christians. Under Nero, who reigned about when? When did Nero reign? And when did Nero die? Just give me a ballpark. Give me a decade.
67.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, great persecution under Nero. Domitian comes later. Great persecution there. And so this means a lot to these people. The background that they understand that. So we take away from chapter 18, what truths? What truths do you take away from chapter 18? What do we learn from this particular chapter? This climax of the fall of Babylon. And again, I like what MacArthur says, that the religious and the commercial Babylon both are going to fall. First of all, that God is what? He's sovereign. And he is powerful. And he will reign. And he will be victorious. And also, his kingdom is forever. And all these earthly kingdoms, whether it be supported by the merchants, the tradesmen, the powers of the earth, the kings of the earth, all these nations, every nation, even the nation we live in, is going to collapse someday. We're not to put our hope and our trust in that, as great as this nation has been, and the privileges and the benefits and beneficence that we receive living here is temporal at best. And so next week, we got a little few minutes. We're going to do a review in a minute. But next week, we're going to go into chapter 19. We only have four chapters to go in this. And so we're going to go through that. But now, you have probably forgotten what is in chapter 1, or chapter 2, or chapter 6. If I ask you that, could you tell me? Flashcards I made. Lousy printing. 7 stars. I'm going to help you out. These are chronological order, as we found them. Who are the 7 stars? I have the angels back answered back here, so it's easy for me. Who are the 7 stars?
Jesus?
Nope.
They're held in the angel's right hand. And they are either...
He must be reading my notes. Go ahead.
They're the messengers of the churches. They may be the pastors, or they're the messengers. It's an interpretive thing. Am I right on that?
You are dead on.
Okay, good. I'm thinking.
It's like you're 22. You're right on target. Yeah, they're either the ministers of the church, or some people think they're the angels, the ministering spirits. So that's the 7 stars. That was in chapter 1. We first were introduced to them in verse 20. Next one. Alan's already passed. Now, he's safe. He can glide in. He'll probably have to answer some more, but he is safe. Get him in early while you can, folks. 24 elders. Now, I understand there's some of these will be differences of interpretation. That's fine. As long as you agree with me, you're in good shape. Who are the 24 elders?
Possibly representing the Old and New Testament church, the tribes and the apostles.
Very good. Very good. She takes a precise relief, so we've had Brenda and Alan. Okay, it's narrowing down. It's narrowing down. Now, that was in chapter 4, verse 4, by the way. Easy one. 4 living creatures.
They circled the throne.
Huh?
They circled the throne.
Okay. More, anything more specific?
The cherubim?
Yeah.
With their six wings.
Do you remember what four faces were on them? Anybody?
An eagle, a lion, a man, and a...
ox.
Ox.
Very good. Chapter 4, verse 7. A scroll. Chapter 5, verse 1. What did the scroll contain, more specifically? What did the scroll contain? It's good to do this review, is it not?
The first round of judgments.
First round of judgments. Yeah, the purposes and plans of God's judgment and redemption. Yeah. This one, you can answer one of two ways. You might want to take this one, because you probably can't be wrong. The white horse, we see in chapter 6, verse 2. He represents what? He goes out and conquers. Very good.
Conquers.
How about the next horse that comes out, you animal lovers? The red horse.
He goes out and conquers.
Very similar, yeah. War, you know, the horse of war. Mars is red, you know. Also, religious persecution. This one, what color's next? Very good. Black represents famine. Yeah, very good. Jan's on a roll. Next one, the pale horse, even has a name. Death and Hades. Yeah, very good. Seven seals, chapter 6 through verse chapter 8, verse 1. Broad answer.
Well, the four horsemen are part of the seven seals, and then so it's like the first round of persecution as well of judgment.
Judgment, yeah. You mathematicians? Do you teach math, Brenda? Okay, Brenda, this your pressure's on. 144,000.
144,000. 12,000 of each tribe of Israel will be saved from the
symbolic of. Some people say the actual Jews, but also
the church.
The church, yeah. Faithful believers, chapter 7, verses 4 through 8. Mm-hmm. Very similar. A great multitude. I can't read my writing here, it's not big enough.
Those were the ones that were sealed, that there was the pause in the judgment and had to be sealed.
Yeah.
It's
faithful of all the ages. Can't count them. There's so many. Seven again, chapter 8, verses 6 through 9. Seven trumpets. What do the trumpets do?
Pronounce judgments.
Yeah, it's pronouncing judgment, pronouncing warning. Sets up the judgments leading up to the second coming. River Euphrates. What does it represent? Yeah, the wicked world. And when it dries up, that's all going to come in. Yeah. It's also back in Genesis, the boundary originally set for Abraham. Remember that? Okay. 42 months. Chapter 11, verse 3. It also goes by the name of?
3.5 years.
Or one more? How many days? How many days, anybody?
1,000
what?
1,206 years.
Very good. Very good. What's it mean? Not seven remembers completeness. 3.5 is half a complete. It's a limited time.
Well, in the millennial interpretation, it really represents the age we're in from Pentecost to Christ's second coming.
Yeah, first and second advent. Two witnesses. I couldn't remember this one. I had to look this one up. The chapter 11, verse 3. Different people are going to interpret this different ways, but we're going to go by my interpretation. Just because I'm sitting here.
I would interpret it as the...
Oh, are you sitting here, Alan?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, that's an interesting one, because but to me it represents the evangelistic thrust of the church.
Very good. Keep passing. Give them a gold star. Woman with 12 stars, chapter 12, verse 1. Some of these are very similar, almost overlapping. Okay? Woman with 12 stars. We've kind of had this before. It comes by different names. Covenant community. That's a tough one. Ooh, this one's one of the easy ones. The seven golden lampstands. This is chapter 12, 1, huh? Yeah, the churches, okay. President's church. Ooh, this one. Everybody will get this one. Be the first to raise your hand. Red dragon. One word. Yeah, Satan. Now that got you primed for this one. Beast of the sea. The first one that came up.
Kingdoms of the earth.
Yep. Very good. You're on a roll. Beast of the earth. Yeah. Mathematicians. Tough one. Mark the beast. Might represent mankind without God. Mark the beast. We're almost done. If I get them apart. Seven bowls of God's wrath. The last of the
division. 7 years of judgment. A bowl each year.
Yep. Now, plays leading up to the second coming of Christ. And finally, this one, last week, the Great Prostitute, chapter 17. Stands for, represents. I can't hear you. Speak up. Be bold.
Idolatry, false religion.
Yep. Babylon, Rome,
Babylon.
The immoral world. Yeah, speak up. Pretend I'm a felon. And then you're arresting me. Okay. Just don't harm me. Okay, with that, chapter 19 next week. We have four chapters to go. Next chapter in your book, which I think is 15. No, 16 in your book, 19 in your Bible.